May it please the court. My name is Stephen Lamb, and I have the honor and privilege of representing Ari Genger. This should have been a straightforward Section 225 case to decide who had the right to vote a block of stock in the company, TRI, that Ari founded. It should have been based on hornbook questions of ratification and the validity of proxies. The proceedings in the Court of Chancery, with the greatest respect, went completely off the rails. The controversy arose because Ari gave shares in TRI to his children while maintaining his voting control. In an unprecedented 225 ruling, the Court of Chancery first held that Ari lost his voting control and then held that Ari lost the ownership of his own shares in his own company. None of this should have happened as a matter of law or equity. I'd like to spend 1 minute on the facts for context and then turn to the issues before the court. Let's start with Ari himself. The opinions below, particularly the early ruling on spoliation and contempt, paint an inaccurate picture of Ari Genger. The undisputed record evidence shows that Ari has served both Israel and America with great distinction. He came here to get an education. In 1985, he founded TRI and grew it to have $158 million in net income in 2008. He served for many years as a special emissary from the Prime Minister Sharon of Israel to the Bush White House. While the Court of Chancery expressed colorful skepticism about this at first, by the time of the trial, the record of Ari's service was clear and undisputed. Next, Ari's family. Ari has two children, Sagi, his son, and Orly, his daughter. In the mid-2000s, Ari and his wife Dahlia divorced. As part of that divorce in 2004, Ari transferred shares of stock in TRI, formerly held by a family-owned company called TPR, to himself and to trusts for Sagi and Orly. He then transferred TPR, stripped of its holdings in TRI, to Dahlia as part of the divorce settlement. The trust shares of TRI were all given in exchange for lifetime irrevocable proxies, allowing Ari to maintain majority voting control of the company. The Court of Chancery found, and we do not challenge here, that the transfers of TRI stock to Ari and to his children's trusts were done without complying with the formal written notice provisions of a stockholders agreement to which the Trump Group were parties. But after the Trump Group concededly knew of the transfers in June of 2008, they chose not to void them. They instead ratified them twice, first by allowing Ari to vote the shares pursuant to his proxies, and second, by buying the Sagi Trust shares at issue here. As a result of that purchase, the Trumps claimed to own a majority of the shares in TRI and attempted to change the composition of the TRI Board of Directors by voting the Sagi shares, even though they knew that those shares were subject to Ari's irrevocable proxy. This Section 225 action followed. The opinions below present sprawling issues. If it pleases your honors, I will address them in turn. First, ratification. Second, proxy validity. Third, the improper overbreadth of the August opinion. And fourth, the erroneous contempt and spoliation rulings.
Spoliation ruling stands totally apart from the merits of the 225 action. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I mean, the only what turns on that is dollars, but not control.
That's correct. And Ari's reputation. He's been held to be someone who is a contemner and who has spoliated evidence, neither of which finding is supported by the record.
Well, doesn't it affect the credibility determinations that the Vice Chancellor made?
It does, Your Honor, and we have not appealed from that aspect of the ruling. We have not sought a new trial on the basis that there was an improper level of proof required in the trial on the merits. May I turn to ratification? Ratification is taking a voluntary and positive action inconsistent with previously asserted rights. Here the Trumps took two actions inconsistent with their position that the transfers were void. First, they allowed Ari to vote the shares at the June stockholders meeting, and then they bought shares from someone they claimed didn't own them. First, quickly, June. By the time of the June 25th stockholders meeting, the Trumps knew everything there was to know about the 2004 transfers and Ari's divorce. They knew about the agreements between Ari and TPR. They knew about TPR's obligation to support the transfers. There's no question that they had full access to all information. They nevertheless allowed Ari to vote at this meeting of stockholders, vote his shares and shares pursuant to the irrevocable proxies he had over his children's shares. And they did that because they wanted him to do so. They wanted him to do so because that meeting, the stockholders did two things. They ratified the transaction with Bank Hapoalim, and they also ratified or approved the so-called funding agreement, which was the Trump's way of obtaining control, majority control of TRI. That is ratification under our law. They next ratified the transactions when they bought the shares from Segi Trust. The core question in this aspect of the case is, who did they buy the shares from? Did they buy them from the Segi Trust, or did they buy them, as they claim, from TPR? They did it pursuant to a stock purchase agreement. The agreement says that the seller is the trust. The agreement says the trust is, and recites the fact, the trust is the record and beneficial owner of the shares. The Trumps paid the consideration, $26 million, to the Segi Trust by wire transfer. The court, they went so far as to ask the Court of Chancery to reissue the share certificate to the Segi Trust because they were unable to locate it. They did that by having Segi file a share certificate, or Segi's trustee, trying to get a new certificate issued. Clearly, looking at that contract, there is no escaping the fact that the seller was the Segi Trust. Well, they say they bought from TPR, but they couldn't buy from TPR. Now, on August 8th, they had filed a letter saying we wish to proceed with our rights under the stockholders' agreement to buy the shares from TPR, and they could have done that pursuant to the contractual remedy provisions in the stockholders' agreement. They didn't. They may have begun that process on August 8th. They abandoned that process within 2 weeks by buying from the Segi Trust. Segi and TPR were both contractually committed to support the 2004 transfers, and the Trumps knew that. TPR could not sell shares to the Trumps or to the other, or to the Trump group, without having first given notice to TRI. TRI was controlled by Ari. So giving notice to TRI was giving notice to Ari, which is precisely what they were not willing to do before they made the purchase from the Segi Trust. There are other reasons under the contract. Eddie and Jules Trump couldn't buy shares from TPR at all. They were simply not permitted transferees. Glenn Clover could not have bought shares without giving notice. It was legally impossible for them to have bought the shares from TPR while complying with either TPR's contractual obligations to Ari or the stockholders' agreement. Well, they say, we didn't buy it really from TPR or Segi. It was a settlement. And this is what the Court of Chancery said when it got to this point in its analysis. It said it was a settlement. But of what? Nothing was settled. There was actually litigation pending at the time between TPR and the Trump group. That litigation wasn't settled. There was no dismissal filed. There was no settlement agreement. There were no releases. There's no contemporaneous suggestion in the documentation that this was a settlement.
Mr. Lamb, excuse me, I gather we're still on ratification.
We are.
The ratification argument is that, as you're delivering it, has a lot of convolutions. But how do you confront the factual finding that was made by the Court of Chancery that at all relevant times the other side, the Trump group, never intentionally forewent any of their rights, and they never intended to ratify anything that was done?
Well, Your Honor, ratification doesn't require that you mean that you set out to ratify. It is taking an action that is inconsistent with the position that you are asserting, the right you are asserting. And they did that here twice. Mm-hmm. They did it in June. They most clearly did it in August by buying shares from the Segi Trust and paying the money to the Segi Trust. And taking the shares that were the Segi Trust shares and having new share certificates reissued to themselves that recite that the shares were those that were owned by the Segi Trust. It's simply impossible now to blink at the fact that those were the Segi Trust shares. And that comes with a price. The Segi Trust shares were burdened with a proxy, an irrevocable proxy in Ari's favor. And perhaps I should turn to that, Your Honor. Although they do make one other argument here. They say, this was an amendment to the stockholders' agreement. It couldn't have been an amendment. TRI was a party to that agreement, and the agreement required unanimous consent to amend, and TRI did not amend. If I may turn quickly to the proxy, Your Honor, having purchased these shares from the Seguin Trust, they then executed a written consent purporting to vote the shares they purchased from the Seguin Trust. They knew it at the time that those shares were subject to an irrevocable proxy in the favor of ARI. Now, under Delaware law, in Section 212E of the Delaware General Corporation Law, two things are required for a proxy to be irrevocable. It must state that it is irrevocable, and it must be coupled with an interest that's sufficient in law. There is no question that this proxy by the Seguin Trust meets those elements. It is titled irrevocable proxy. It says in its text that it is an irrevocable proxy. It was undoubtedly coupled with an interest sufficient at law. ARI was himself the owner of 14% of the stock. He was the chairman and CEO and founder of the corporation. It is impossible to conclude that he did not have a sufficient interest. The proxy was also valid under New York law. The court below analyzed it under both. Under New York law, the court concluded that it was not valid because he concluded that under New York law, you must have been a stockholder. Both parties must have been stockholders at the instant that the proxy was given. That's a provision that isn't found in New York law. New York law requires that the agreement to give the proxy must be in writing. There was an agreement here in writing. It's part of the record. And it must have been signed by the parties. And it was signed. And indeed, even the finding that they were not stockholders at the moment they gave is not supported in law. I mean, these were people who were sitting down, essentially at a table, exchanging shares on the one hand and an agreement to give a proxy and a proxy on the other. And that's how it happened. And indeed, as a matter of fact, the Seguin proxy wasn't fully executed by the trust until the day after the shares were issued. So it boils down, I think, to the question of whether under Delaware law, there's some provision that says you can have what is an irrevocable proxy, and yet it can be revoked by transferring it to someone else. And that is just inconsistent with the very notion of what an irrevocable proxy is. It would do great injury to our law. There are many people who rely in business on irrevocable proxies for various things, securing loans and other things like that. And it is preposterous to say that the proxy can be revoked simply by transferring the shares. And indeed, New York law recognizes this. The same section of the New York Business Corporation Law the Vice Chancellor cited also says that, quite specifically, that irrevocable proxies are not revoked by transfer to someone taking with notice. There's no question the Trumps took with notice. The stock purchase agreement includes a representation by the Trumps that they have received and understand the documentation regarding this proxy. So not only does Ari have a valid proxy on his shares, he also is the rightful owner of his own shares. The Court of Chancery found this in July, in its July 23rd opinion. The Court of Chancery found that notwithstanding the fact that Ari failed to give notice to the Trumps of the transfer to himself, that Ari was someone who was a permitted transferee under the agreement. He had the right to transfer the stock to himself, and it would be a completely inequitable and irresponsible remedy to deprive Ari of his own shares simply because he transferred them without giving notice. Now, this I think does implicate the scope of Section 225 proceedings. As this Court has recognized, Section 225 hearings are summary and are limited to narrow issues. Generally speaking, judgments in 225 actions are in rem, and that what is being decided is the right to hold office, either as an officer or as a director of a corporation. The courts may address and resolve issues necessary to resolve the election issue, but those determinations generally, as I say, are in rem. Here, the resolution of issues regarding the ARI shares and the Orley Trust shares clearly was not necessary to the resolution of the 225 determination. Indeed, the Orley Trust wasn't even a party to the proceeding. Orley herself was not a party to the proceeding. Her trust certainly was not a party to the proceeding. Having recognized Ari's right to his shares in the July 23rd opinion, in the August letter opinion in which the court treats it as a motion for reconsideration, the court abandoned the very restraint it had shown in the August opinion, and it reached a very inequitable result that is not supported by equity, it's not supported by the stockholder agreement, and it should be reversed. But even if the court reached the conclusion that Ari should, it was correct in reaching the conclusion that Ari loses his shares, those shares go back to TPR. That's the issue that was litigated in this case. It was, do they belong to Ari or do they go back to TPR? Everyone understood during the course of this litigation that the issue, the question of whether if the shares went back to TPR, what was going to happen to them is something that would have to be litigated in an action involving TPR, involving Ari's son, Sagi, from whom he is estranged, and involving other parties. And that litigation was going to have to take place in New York because it involved issues arising out of Ari and Dahlia's divorce and the separation of their property, and it would require a reformation of the divorce decree. The Court of Chancery was aware of the disputes over TPR's authority and Sagi's authority, and the Court of Chancery was aware that those were issues that would have to be resolved in New York. Let me say that the Court of Chancery eventually, in this August opinion, reaches a side letter, what's called the side letter. It's this one page or page and a half document that's attached to the, or was executed at the same time as the stock purchase agreement with the Sagi Trust. It purports to dispose of, to transfer all of Ari's shares and the Orley Trust shares and to sell them or give, doesn't actually purport to sell them, it gives the Trump Group an option to purchase them. And it does so at a price, it's quite hard to calculate, but I can tell you the price works out to be considerably less than half on a per share basis than the Sagi Trust sold its shares for. Altogether, if you add what they paid for the Sagi Trust shares and what they would pay under this side letter for the Orley and Ari shares, the purchase price for 51% of the stock in TRI amounts to less than a third of the income earned by TRI in 2008. They earned $158 million. The total purchase price comes in more like $44. Nevertheless, this side letter that the Court of Chancery enforced, or so said he was enforcing in the August opinion, certainly wasn't necessary to the 225 proceeding. As I said, the parties to it were not all present. The court said he overlooked it. He didn't overlook it. It wasn't litigated. It wasn't addressed in the parties' post-trial briefs. It wasn't argued at the post-trial argument that took place before the July 23rd opinion was issued. It was a mere option to purchase. It clearly had nothing to do with anyone's voting rights or the disposition of a 225 action, however you look at it. It was unnecessary in any way to reach that question. I mean, one would have to ask, how can an unexercised option have any relevance to a 225 action? Let me move to the contempt. The contempt and spoliation decisions. These rest on the unsupportable premise that it was a violation of a routine status quo order to overwrite the unallocated space in the computers at TRI, the company's server and Ari's computer. This cannot be the law. It was based that conclusion was based on a complete misunderstanding of the operation of the normal operation of computers. And for that to be the law would disturb every Delaware corporation that ever finds itself involved in litigation from today on.
Well, isn't there a two-step process here? First, there's the deletion or the doing some action on the computer that causes the document to go to the unallocated space, and then the deletion or erasing of the unallocated space.
Yes, but Your Honor, here, may I, if I could answer that question just by telling you what happened the weekend, the 2 days before this action took place? Those 2 days, it's happened at the end of a weekend in which Ari, working with his lawyers, the company lawyers, and computer experts that were hired by the company's lawyers for this purpose, spent the whole weekend working around the clock to preserve every active user file on TRI's computers. And every active user file...
The status quo order preceded that by how many days?
Oh, it was entered at the end of August, I believe, and this was September 8th and 9th or something.
So there is a period of time where there could be a deletion before this preservation.
There's no evidence of that, Your Honor. There is no evidence. The evidence at trial showed that there was no evidence of any unusual deletion activity. Indeed, the very documents that they point to as having been deleted, there were multiple copies of the same documents found on TRI's files. 9 copies of the Lentz memo were made available in the course of this litigation. There was no effort to delete the Lentz memo. There's no evidence to support that as a conclusion, Your Honor.
That evidence doesn't exist because of the clean sweep.
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I have to disagree with you. There is no evidence of any unusual deletion activity between the time the status quo order was entered and the time of this weekend spent preserving documents. There simply is none. The one thing they point to is this Lentz memo, which was received by Ari in June. And his testimony was that he received it on his handheld or he received it at somebody's house or something, and he deleted it, which would never have caused a copy of it to be in the unallocated space of the computers at work anyway. No, it's a total red herring. There is no evidence.
In terms of forgetting for a moment whether any specific document was wiped out or not, wouldn't it be fair to say that it is not in the normal course of business to sweep or wipe out the unallocated space in a computer?
I think that's not correct either, Your Honor.
Wait a second. Was there evidence that the company did this every 2 months and today was the day they were supposed to do it?
There certainly was evidence in the record that the company had used this very process at earlier times in earlier years. But every computer, if it's an IBM or if it's a Macintosh or it must be my whistle. If it runs on Microsoft software, has a routine process where it goes through and it reallocates the unallocated, it defrags and so on and so forth.
I understand that whatever is in unallocated space can in fact be destroyed or written over because the computer needs that space for new information. I get that general principle. But my understanding is that to the extent that no effort is made to totally sweep that unallocated space, then whatever may still be there can be, with some difficulty, reconstructed to a large extent. And that it was the deletion of what could have been additional evidence in that unallocated space that the court was concerned with.
I think it's fair that is what the court was concerned with, but it's not a legitimate concern by any stretch of the imagination. Unallocated space is not a depository of records. It is not some place one goes to find documents.
Well, one does go to unallocated space when you can't find something else, documents you expect to find, and there's a belief, for example, that the documents have been deleted from the regular portion of the computer. If they've been deleted, they would be in the unallocated space unless, as it happens, the computer had needed that space to overwrite. But if it hadn't been overwritten in the normal course of events, it could be reconstructed from that unallocated space.
It is possible, Your Honor, with extreme effort to go into a computer in the unallocated space, which is like confetti at the bottom of a trash basket. And as the terrorists did in Tehran when they took over the U.S. embassy, you can spend a year trying to put it back together and see if you can get a memo. It is not something that a routine status quo order requires any corporation to preserve. You don't have to take any step to preserve it. You can use software that you use to change it. Every time you open the computer or close it, it changes. There is simply no way to preserve it. And in this case, there was no evidence to suppose that there had been any process of deletion that would have required. Now, Your Honor, I have 30 seconds left. May I reserve it for rebuttal?
May it please the Court. I want to speak briefly about some facts that Mr. Lamb talked about. Mr. Ganger did give shares to his children The court found that those children were not permitted transferees under the stockholders' agreement. That violated the stockholders' agreement and gave rise to a right under Section 3.2 of the stockholders' agreement to buy all of the transferred shares, not just the ones to non-permitted transferees, but all. The reason for that is that the transfer to family members had been discussed when the stockholders' agreement was negotiated and rejected. The reason it had been rejected was because there were fights in the Ganger family, and my clients, the Trump Group, did not want to be involved with those fights. That is found by the Vice Chancellor in his opinion. This is, I think, a conventional appeal. This case was tried twice to Vice Chancellor Strine, 5 days of trial in which all parties were subjected to cross-examination, 1,400 pages of live testimony, hundreds of thousands of pages of documents, and testimony from two computer forensic experts, one court-appointed neutral expert and the Trump Group's expert. Mr. Genger's expert did not testify. After that trial, the court found as facts the following: that Mr. Genger authorized his agent Ohana to destroy information on TRI's computer system, that Mr. Genger authorized his agent to use a computer program called SecureWipe to wipe or permanently erase the entirety of the unallocated space on Mr. Genger's computer and TRI's entire server, that Mr. Genger did so knowingly, knowing he was subject to a court order, knowing that intentionally to reduce the base of information available to the Trump Group, and intending to limit the ability of the Trump Group to find additional documents that might aid it in its litigation battles with him, that he did not consult with counsel for TRI, who had warned him not to do it, that he did not consult with the court, and that he did not consult with his adversaries, that it is likely that the unallocated space that he erased included relevant documents, including the Lentz memo, which Your Honors may have seen in the briefs, and eight other emails, some with attachments, from his lawyer David Lentz, all of which addressed critical issues in the Section 225 case. And as a consequence, Vice Chancellor Strine found, quote, "I conclude that Genger's behavior had the effect of destroying evidence that was likely relevant to the Section 225 action." Now, Mr. Lamb has argued that there was no unusual deletion activity. And the reason for that, of course, is that the unallocated space was wiped. Mr. Lamb has argued that the use of SecureClean had been done in the past, but there is no question, Your Honors, that this use of wiping software was not routine, anything but routine. It was intended to take out everything that was on that system. The unallocated space, in response to your question, Justice Berger, is the first place that forensic computer experts go to look for documents in a contested case, and in particular where there are documents that appear to be missing from the active files. And the Vice Chancellor so found.
Can it also be inferred that this was done really for no reasons related to this litigation, but because of the personal information and the potential Israeli-connected information? And is that...
Mr. Genger so argues, but the Vice Chancellor found differently. The Vice Chancellor found particularly that there was an intent to limit the information available to the Trump Group in pending litigation between the Trump Group and Mr. Genger, who authorized this wiping. That's a finding of the trial.
Mr. Hallingham, if I understand Mr. Lamb's argument correctly, it is that, number one, there could not have been there was no basis for a contempt finding because absent an explicit provision in the status quo order prohibiting wiping of the unallocated space, it can't be supposed that Mr. Genger had any reason to know that he was doing anything contempt worthy. And secondly, there was no evidence of any harm as far to the discovery process, and therefore no foul. I gather your response to the second point would be the Vice Chancellor's finding that it was likely that other evidence had been destroyed that was material to the case.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree.
So my question on that point is, what was the basis for the likelihood finding? And then secondly, the state of mind question that I reverted to earlier.
On the likelihood finding, Your Honor, David Lentz was Mr. Genger's personal lawyer, belatedly produced documents in connection with a very late deposition in the trial. And in those documents were 8 emails, with some with attachments, none of which, all to Mr. Genger, none of which was on the TRI computer system. We were able to get copies of those documents from other sources, but that was, in the Vice Chancellor's view, powerful evidence that there had been many documents deleted.
In other words, those documents were not on the computer after it was wiped, and they should have been.
Not on the active part of the computer, not on the unallocated space, because the unallocated space had been wiped. But if the documents had been deleted, they would have been on the unallocated space absent the wiping.
Okay.
And that was the point that the Vice Chancellor made. As to the, it's not contempt worthy because Mr. Genger must not have known that that there are important pieces of information on the unallocated space. I have two responses, Your Honor. The first is, that's an argument that is brand new in this court, and it's based on the opinion of a couple of bloggers who say this is going to bring corporate America to its knees. The Vice Chancellor addressed this question or thought about this question and said, I find that people who have an innocent belief about what they're doing would simply say, well, I'll call the other side and say, is this okay? Or maybe I'll ask for a conference with the court and say, I'm planning to wipe the entirety of the unallocated space on the TRI server and my computer, is that okay? Or maybe even just, we have a problem, we did some encryption, which I didn't get advance permission from you to do, Your Honor, but we did some encryption and we think there may now be some unencrypted duplicate files on the unallocated space. Could we work out a solution to that problem? Mr. Genger did none of that. Instead, he directed his agent in the middle of the night to wipe the computer systems clean. And that is not an indication of innocent intent. And the Vice Chancellor, once again, having seen Mr. Ohana, Mr. Genger, and all of the parties to this case, reached that credibility finding.
Now, the other side says that there's no evidence of a deletion after the status quo order.
I think there are two, they do say that, Your Honor. There are two responses. First, there is, that it's not true. There is evidence of deletion. What Mr. Lamb said precisely was there is no evidence of unusual deletion. That means that there was evidence of deletion, and even one document that is a critical document like the Lentz memo or the 8 Lentz emails would be more than enough for a finding of contemptuous behavior. So the argument is not an answer, but in addition to that,
but even evidence that those documents were deleted after the status quo order.
There is no evidence that the documents were deleted after the status quo order. There is no evidence that the documents were not deleted after the status quo order. The evidence of their deletion would have been on the unallocated space, where fragments would have remained reflecting the date of their deletion, and that information too was gone. In addition, it is not critical whether the documents, the active documents, were deleted after the status quo order or before. There was a ripe dispute among these parties as early as August 8th, actually earlier than that, but a lawsuit had been filed by August 8th. And so the August 29th status quo order is not the critical date in any event. There was exfoliation duties.
It's a critical date as far as contempt is concerned. But
not exfoliation, Your Honor.
You mentioned that there were two bloggers that raised issues about the danger to corporate America
as
a conclusion in regard to the unallocated space. What about the issues that are raised in the amicus brief and the concerns that are expressed there? Should we simply discount them as non-blogging worthy, or are they serious?
I don't think that they're serious. I would say first, Your Honor, that these arguments, which could have been raised in the trial court, and I say that because Mr. Ganger could have called his own expert or addressed these concerns with the court-appointed neutral or our expert, both of whom testified. I don't know who these amicus people are. I never had a chance to cross-examine them. The court took testimony on how computer systems work from these two experts, and the court reached conclusions about how computer systems work, and the court reached different conclusions than the amicus reaches. And in that circumstance, the court's findings should be the ones that control. But I would say this. This trial court's ruling is nothing like the ruling that the amicus describes. This is not a document the announcement of a new document preservation rule. This is the reiteration of a very old rule. Do not destroy documents in the face of a court order. We do not argue, Your Honor, and I don't think that the Vice Chancellor would suggest that this is a new rule that says the normal and incremental overwriting of fragments, documents, files, and data on the unallocated space needs to be suspended immediately, bringing corporate America to its knees. That's not what the Vice Chancellor was ruling on. I will say that there may be circumstances in which a party might say, I'm very worried about the preservation of the unallocated space, and go to his adversaries or the trial court and say, this is a special instance in which steps would need to be taken. But that's not what the ruling is here. The ruling is here, don't take a piece of software and eradicate evidence. Don't do it, at least not without first consulting with your adversaries in the court.
Do you agree that the status quo order then would not prohibit the routine overwriting of unallocated space?
I do agree that, Your Honor. I agree that the functioning of the operational system in a typical computer, which does, as you delete a new document, go and look for a cluster in which to put it on the unallocated space and may or may not overwrite old clusters, I don't think the status quo order affected that process, which goes on in every corporation in America, at all. It has to do, and it prohibits destruction, affirmative acts.
That's what it has to do. Other than turning the computer on and off.
Correct. Intentional affirmative acts, which is what the Vice Chancellor found in this case.
So by the same logic, you would find no conflict with the Seventh Circuit's principle on preservation of data when it excludes unallocated disk space on the hard drive?
No, I would quibble with that, Chief Justice, only in this sense. There is no question, and the Vice Chancellor found, that there are recoverable pieces of evidence on an unallocated space. There are, and nobody really disputes that. Certainly the Vice Chancellor found it on the basis of the testimony of the forensic computer experts who testified. What I would say to Your Honor is I have no quibble with the Seventh Circuit's principle that the normal incremental overwriting of that is a function of the operation of the computer. Rust, if you will, is okay. What is not okay is affirmative action taken with the intent of eradicating everything on the unallocated space, all of the evidence on the unallocated space, a nuclear explosion, if you will. So it's rust versus conflagration.
Okay. At the risk of continuing to deal with the tail rather than the dog here, are you going to turn to the scope of the 225 action, the issue of ratification, and the
yes, Your Honor.
Substantive issues?
On ratification, let me just say, I think it's helpful to have a theoretical framework. This is not explicit ratification. No one said, Ari, it's okay, the 2004 transfers are okay, despite the fact that we have rights under the stockholders' agreement. So we're looking at ratification by conduct. And the theoretical framework that we should think about there is this. Unless a party behaves in a way that can only be explained by his acceptance of the purportedly ratified act, there can be no implicit ratification or ratification by conduct. And in this case, that showing by Mr. Ganger, and it is his burden, must be by clear and convincing evidence as a consequence of his contemptuous conduct. Now, the two events here both admit clearly of alternative explanations than ratification. On the June 25th vote, my clients asked Mr. Genger for a representation that he could vote the relevant shares no matter who owned them, a clear indication that the proxy, which Mr. Genger was showing to my clients, was not the only contender for ownership of those shares. There were also perfectly plausible ways in which Mr. Genger could vote those shares if they were owned by TPR as a result of the 2004 transfers being void. For example, a proxy could have been granted from TPR to Mr. Genger. Or, for example, in arguments that he makes in this court, well, not in this court, but in the trial court, if the 2004 transfers are void, he says voting control of TPR should revert back to me. So there are perfectly plausible explanations for our acceptance of the vote on the funding agreement and the bank agreement that are consistent with the 2004 transfers being void. And Mr. Genger represented that he had the power to vote those shares no matter who owned them. The signature block on the funding agreement, for example, makes that clear. And Mr. Genger's own lawyer, Mr. Lentz, admitted that that was okay. As to the August 22 purchase, Your Honors, the transactional documents themselves speak in the alternative. They say, we're buying these shares. The seller is identified as the Segee Trust because that's the owner of the shares on the stock book of TRI, which Mr. Genger controls, and we can't change it. But alternatively, if the owner of the shares is found to be TPR, we're buying them from TPR. There can be no clearer indication that this is not a ratification of only one side of that alternative structure. So as a fact, there was no ratification in either case.
What is your response to the argument that the proxy meets all the criteria for revocability?
Your Honor, if I may, I'm going to answer just a slightly different question. I'm going to let go the issue of irrevocability and just say this. That proxy, on its face, does not prohibit sale of the shares, and that proxy, on its face, says the proxy holder has the same rights that the proxy grantor would have, and the proxy holder can vote the shares owned by the proxy grantor. And both of those statements in the proxy itself make clear that the proxy does not survive the sale of the shares. And if we have any doubt about that, our courts have consistently said that proxies, which by definition separate economic interests from voting interests, should be strictly construed. We're going to permit that separation, but we're going to strictly construe the language.
Okay, so your answer is that the language of this particular proxy
exactly
caused the irrevocability feature to evaporate when there was a sale.
Well, the proxy evaporates. As long as the proxy existed, it was irrevocable, but the proxy was a limited proxy. It only applied as long as TPR owned the shares. Sorry, the trusts owned the shares. Finally, as to the scope of the 225 proceeding and the notion that the vice chancellor exceeded his authority, let me say this. The vice chancellor found that Mr. Genger himself asked the court to declare who was the rightful owner of the RE trust, of the RE shares and the Orley trust shares. His answer and counterclaim sought an explicit declaration, I'm quoting from it, that Mr. Genger is the rightful owner of 13.99% of TRI shares, and the Orley Trust is the rightful owner of 19.43% of TRI shares. And in the stipulated pretrial order filed less than a week before trial, Mr. Genger's statement of relief sought included a, quote, finding that Mr. Genger owns 794 shares of TRI common stock and that the Orley Trust owns the equity interest in 1,102 shares. In his reply brief in this court, Mr. Genger concedes that he did, quote, seek to have these issues of ownership adjudicated simultaneously in the proceedings below. Your Honors, it was only when he lost that Mr. Ganger claimed that the Vice Chancellor lacked the authority to make the rulings that Mr. Ganger himself had asked the court to make. He's stopped from making that argument now for that reason. Now, maybe Mr. Lamb is trying to stand in the shoes of Orley Ganger. Orley Ganger came to this court and asked to intervene, but when she did that, just like Mr. Ganger, who wanted to take a free bite at the apple to see if he would win on the determination of ownership, his daughter did the same thing. She said, I'd like to intervene, but by the way, I'd like to preserve my right to challenge personal jurisdiction in the case that is the subject of this appeal. And this court, I think, quite rightly said, well, you can't have it both ways. And so the argument is not properly before this court. But on the merits of the argument, Section 225 cases frequently, their purpose is to determine voting rights to the shares and frequently address issues that are required to be addressed in order to determine those voting rights. And ownership is one of those determinations. Now, the Vice Chancellor, in his August opinion, determined that because the shareholders' agreement had a provision that said the ownership of these minority shares determines the title to two of the six board seats by contract, he did have to decide the ownership of those shares. Mr. Ganger had asked him to do it, but separate and apart from that, the shareholders' agreement required determination of that ownership in order to determine who owned the board seat, who gets to sit in the board seat. And so it was required determination in order to do what Section 225 is designed to be done.
But the response to that, if I understand it correctly, is yes, that may be the case for 225 purposes, but not for ultimate ownership purposes. For that latter purpose, the court in New York is going to have to decide who the ultimate owner is, creating the risk that whatever the adjudication was in Delaware could be undone later.
I would say this, Your Honor. I do understand the argument. I would offer to the court my view that I think that any party who voluntarily chooses not to show up in the Chancery Court, there are consequences of that, but I think that party presumably preserves that party's right to argue whatever that party wants to argue with respect to ownership somewhere else, and the Vice Chancellor's findings will, I'm sure, be a subject of that argument. I would say that the Vice Chancellor made specific findings here that Mr. Ganger and his daughter were acting in concert. There is certainly case law in Delaware that suggests that in that circumstance, Ms. Ganger may have taken the risk that she's bound by the ruling below, but she's got her arguments, of course, and the restatement of judgments says the same, that persons acting in concert may both be bound even where one is not before.
Well, it is procedurally, it is possible to join in a 225 action, a separate action for plenary relief. Was that done here? That is there any evidence in the record that there was a plenary claim separate and apart from the 225?
Separate and apart from the Section 225 notion that there are issues that need to be decided for the voting rights? The answer to that is no, Your Honor, but keep in mind a reason for that is that Mr. Ganger had consistently said, I want all these issues decided by the Vice Chancellor. In fact, Mr. Carroll stood up and said, we want everything should be decided in Delaware, Your Honor. From my perspective, I thought these issues were already before.
It's one thing for everyone to agree that there is a plenary claim in the suit, and another for everybody to agree that the jurisdiction of the court, the subject matter jurisdiction of the court under 225, can be expanded.
Oh, I agree with that, Your Honor, and I do think that as I said, Orley Ganger, having decided not to come to court, retains her arguments that she's not bound by collateral effects of the voting determination that is clearly within the court's power.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, Ari Ganger gave his shares to the Sagi Trust. The Trump Group voided that transfer. They instead bought, or I should say they didn't void that transfer. They bought from the trust. That is ratification. The Frank case, decided by the Supreme Court of Delaware before this august body was actually formed, holds that conscious intent is not an element of ratification. On the contempt issue, Your Honor, if I may refer to on page 63 of the contempt hearing, in the cross-examination of Mr. Allingham's expert, he was asked if that email, this is the Lentz email, had been deleted when Mr. Ganger received it in June. Could it be long gone and unrecoverable in September? Is that right? The answer is absolutely yes. I've spent much time on that issue. I think I will move on.
Well, Mr. Lamb, you're out of time. If you have one summary sentence or so, fine.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I just wanted to say what we're asking the court to do is to reverse the July opinion and hold that the Sagi Trust shares were ratified and that they were purchased by the Trumps subject to the irrevocable proxy. I would ask this court to vacate the August opinion as simply beyond the scope of the court's power. No one ever asked the court to decide anything about the side letter. It was not litigated. It cannot have been decided. And also to reverse the December opinion that held that Ari Ganger was in contempt of court and that he had spoliated evidence. You can't spoliate evidence, Your Honor, without there being something missing, material information necessary to the other side. There is no evidence that anything like that happened. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.